No?
Yes?
Don't see it.
We'll try again, can I?
And try detect. This is the wrong one. Here's switch. Okay, we're just going to give, what time is it? 4:03. Let's just give a couple minutes for people to join us. Thank you for coming to the session. We're about to get started. For the space issue, I think we'll be good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Who goes first? You go first. Sorry.
Yep.
Let's see how I do this best.
I think we're fine on space. So if you are sitting in the back, we welcome you to come forward and join the group.
Close the doors.
So, welcome. I am not Elise Garrick, but Elise is tied up in another meeting, so I'm going to proxy for her. And what we're going to do today is talk about methods by which we could enable future directory services for domain registration data. So the objectives here are really to share information and to try to try to approach a problem that has been persistent in the community for over a dozen years, certainly before I came to ICANN. And over time, we've been using the WHOIS protocol for support of access to domain name registration data, and various times through the cycle of analysis of the adequacies or inadequacies of the protocol or the service, different parties, including ICANN's Security and Stability Advisory Committee, have asked the community to consider not only requirements for a registration data access, but for a broader directory service access that would include and facilitate access to domain registration data. So the first goal is to actually, you know, try to understand exactly what those requirements are and to, you know, to think about those. And the second is to better understand some of the existing technologies, including IRIS and RESTful Whois, that might be interesting candidates for a service that would support a directory service in the broader sense. What we're going to do is actually begin with a presentation of the RESTful Web Whois service that that Aaron has been experimenting with and is piloting, as I understand right now. Andy will go into more details with that, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about requirements, and then we'll talk about, you know, how the technical group that's been working can proceed and consider next steps. So, Andy?
All right. can we go ahead and switch over to my laptop? Okay. My name is Andy Newton. I'm the chief engineer for the American Registry for Internet Numbers. And I'm going to talk about the RESTful Whois service that Aaron has fielded. I wish I could say that I just wandered into this space, but that's not true. Some time ago, and I can't remember how many years ago this was, there's an RC which has a date on it. I did an LDAP experiment trying to put Whois data into LDAP, and then shortly thereafter there was the CRISP working group and the IETF, and my name is on a lot of those RFCs as well. Beyond that, I've also had the pleasure of working with some of the people who did other efforts, notably RWhois and Whois++ when I was at VeriSign. And but most recently at Aaron, we have done the RESTful Whois web service. So, and that's really what the focus of this presentation is about. But because I mentioned all those other protocols, and because we are talking about something other than port 43, there's going to be a lot of natural comparisons between different protocols. And so, let's start with the basics of what how these protocols are all put together. And this is true of almost anything, any type of data. Exchange protocol on the internet. You have essentially a control part or control plane of the protocol, which deals with framing, you know, how many octets did you send across, blah, 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 security, that kind of stuff. And then you have the data part, which is really the thing, it's really the part that users are interested in. So let's compare these protocols. So we have LDAP, which is a directory service protocol, and LDAP has a pretty thick a control plane which heavily dictates what you put into the data plane. And by that I mean, you know, the data part you put into LDAP has to be a tree structure. It's ASNBER encoded, all that fine stuff about RDNs and whatnot. It's not what I would consider a rich data set. Then you have IRIS, which was the product of the IETF CRISP working group. The data part there is a little more freeform than what you get with LDAP, although not as freeform as what you would see on the web. But one of the central things you should take away from how IRIS is put together is both the control part and the data part are very much glued together, and they were meant for each other. On the polar opposite of that, we have this thing called Port 43, the nickname protocol, originally specified in RFC something before DNS was standardized. But essentially, the way Whois nickname protocol works is you have a control plane which is extremely thin and says almost nothing about what data gets thrown over the pipe. And then you have RESTful Web Services, or in this case, it's actually just HTTP, or the web as we call it, which has a very nice control plane that allows very extensible data parts to be exchanged. So why would you want to go to a RESTful web service? The answer there is actually found in RFC 3707, which is one of the CRISP working group documents. If you want to do things like internationalization support, if you want to do referrals, you want to do security, port 43 is not really going to help you. But if you want to do those things, that leads you to one conclusion, and when you look at the thin veneer that port 43 is over the data, is that there are no hooks there to hang your hat on for extending the protocol. If you want to do it and maintain backwards compatibility, not break half the things that are being used out there, you're going to end up bending over backwards to get it done. So that really leads you to one conclusion, which is to go beyond port 43. So the port 43 solutions, we have RWHOIS, which is seen as a very problem-specific technology. It's used by a subset of the Aaron community. WHOIS++, which is was in the 90s in the IETF, it didn't really focus so much on the data part, but mostly on centralized indexes. LDAP, which is actually widely used, it's just not widely used as a public internet service. It's mostly used within enterprises and intranets, but it's not really considered a public internet service. IRIS, which was the creation of the IETF CRISP working group, which didn't really get a lot of adoption, and it really is a kind of a protocol designed by a committee, and the requirements were over-lawyered. And then the RESTful Web Services, which is what we're talking about here, which is nothing more than a simple reuse pattern of HTTP. So what is REST? We didn't make this up. REST is it's called a representation state transfer. It's the thesis by Roy Fielding. And when it's basically when you apply it to the web, you got two accesses of or two premises going on there. One is to take the HTTP verbs, post, get, put, and so forth, and you apply them to the CRUD operations you do on data. Of course, we're talking about who is here. You don't really do posts and puts with who is. That really leaves only get. And then the other axis is you have resources. Basically, everything is an addressable URL. This is a very RESTful web services are very popular with Amazon and Google. If you were a software developer and you wanted to use Amazon's S3 data services, it's a RESTful web service. What does that mean in the context of WHOIS? Well, for us, we have a bunch of different types of what you would call, if you were a database person, entities. We have POCs and orgs and nets and so forth. And each one of those things we modeled as a separate URL that you can cut and paste and hand around to your friends. You can put it on the back of your business cards. Here's my POC at Aaron. Because everyone wants to do that, right? But what that does is that gives you a very simple programmatic API into the data set. Compared to nickname port 43, you therefore have some concrete inputs that you can get in. You can standardize them if you want to. And you also have a way of expressing what type of output you're going to get. And then on the side benefit of that is you get to reuse all that HTTP infrastructure that everyone's paid for and developed over the years. More information if you want to know more about REST. There's a good book by O'Reilly Media called RESTful Web Services. This is a technical book, but if you were a non-technical person, you pick this book up, the first two or three chapters, you would probably read them and go, oh, okay, I get this. It's not a heavyweight book at all. So if you want to know more about the subject in general, I suggest you go get that book. What does this mean as applying to the problem domain that ICANN's looking into, the ICANN community's looking into? Well, RESTful web services in general are not an out-of-the-box solution. It's not something you just go say, go do RWS and you're done. Someone's going to have to define and decide the different patterns you use. But once you've done that, those patterns and how to express them and how people understand them, it's well within the mainstream of internet communications. You can go hire programmers off the street who, if they're worth anything, they'll understand this technology. And then, on the other side of that, the RIR, such as Aaron, we're fielding these things today, so we're actually showing how it can be done. Aaron's service, we announced it, I think, in late 2009. We went full production in July of 2010. It was so successful that we had people asking us to go much further than just a WHOIS service, and so we were actually on the eve of doing a RESTful provisioning service as well. The RIPE NCC also has a RESTful WHOIS service. They announced it in March 2010, and it's now in production. And while APNIC, I don't believe they have any public RESTful services, they have been using RESTful services behind the scenes for years for gluing their systems together. Again, and the reason we all did this was the big advantages here. We could take our three and four programmers that we have and throw them at this problem because it was an easily understood problem. And everything we had, we just reused that whole web technology, the HTTP stacks we had, and we had a solution. And this is also why you have a lot of very large corporate companies like Google and so forth who've adopted this. And anytime you pick up like your Facebook app off of your iPhone and it's talking back to the Facebook servers, it's using a RESTful service. What does it look like? You know, I kept talking about the resource all resources are URLs. So this is a URL which identifies a point of contact in the Aaron system. It's for the gentleman sitting next to me, Mark Costers. If you go ahead and you put that into your, I notice everyone's got laptops open, so you can go ahead and put that into your browser, and you will actually pull up the information on Mark Costers. Everyone's doing it. There we go. Oh, you want to see it?
What does it say? I'm really Mac 21 at Aaron.
Yeah, yes, so good. Mark puts a lot of useful information into his records. No, we don't. We have a very good reason for not doing that. Again, we're talking about addressable URLs, so we can identify Mark Costers, the person. We can identify Aaron, the organization, by saying /org/Aaron. We can even hang relationships off of these URLs. You don't have to know all the POCs that Aaron has connected to its org. You would just say /org/Aaron/POCs. Boom. There's all the points of contact that Aaron has, so forth. And you can continue doing this. The other thing you can do is you can start formulating different search patterns as well. So if we wanted to know, we didn't know that Aaron was the handle for the organization Aaron in our database, but you wanted to search for all organizations with the name Aaron, you could say, well, here's a search pattern, orgs, and then I use a matrix parameter in order to specify the name Aaron. Or I can do organizations starting with Aaron and so forth. You can get fancier. You can say things like, I want the points of contact that have a first name of Mark and the last name of Costers, so forth. So that's how you would do. That's one way of doing searches. On the other side, you have outputs. So because this is the web, there's a variety of outputs we can have. XML is a pretty good example. It's very, very, very common. And the reasons for that are because it's easily digestible by computers. It's easy to work with for programmers, and you can apply style sheets to it so everyone else can understand it. But JSON's also there. JSON's a very popular data serialization format used by a lot of JavaScript programmers, a lot of people who do AJAX programming and so forth. On top of that, what Aaron support is we do XML as our primary output, the one we put a lot of emphasis behind. We also do translations to JSON, text, and plain HTML. So we output all four of those things. But again, showing that what you can do with the XML is you have on the blue part, if you could read it, a bunch of XML. XML data, which the machines can read and people with personalities like machines can read. And then what you can do is you can take that and you can throw it into the browser, and boom, you have something that's user-friendly for the constituencies that you have. And notice I said browser. That answers one of the questions people have when you talk about replacing port 43 or doing something beyond port 43 is what are we going to do for the clients? Okay, we can all, you know, the different operators can write servers, but if no one's going to write a client, then it's kind of useless. Likewise, the people who write clients, some of them do it for free in their spare time, they're not going to do this unless there are servers out there. So it's kind of a chicken and egg type situation. We don't really have that with RESTful Web Services because the clients already exist. Like I said, I showed you your browser is one of them. There are other command line clients like GET and curl, which a lot of Unix programmers or Unix systems administrators know. And when I say you can go out and talk to, you can get any programmer worth his salt to help you with a RESTful Web Service, they'll all come back and they'll say, well, I need an embedded client of some type, and there's dozens and dozens of HTTP clients out there for people to choose from depending on their platform and language. Again, this is all just applying everything we do with the web today to the problem of who is using RESTful patterns. So when you do use that infrastructure, you also get things like caching. HTTP caching is a well-known part of the infrastructure. So let's say, for instance, and this is a real example, we have people that query the Aaron services. I think our Whois services, 99% of our Whois queries are, I have an IP address, I want to know the network. That's very, very common. And it happens that you have security analyzers like intrusion detection services or spam analyzers or so forth that are getting runs, are getting hits against them. And what they want to know is they want to know the information behind where the attack's coming from. And as opposed to constantly querying us for the same IP address over and over and over again, if they took commercial off-the-shelf caching infrastructure, put it between us and them, they would actually get a much faster analysis. You can embed referrals with HTTP. You can embed referrals right at the HTTP level if you want to. And some of our, if you use our Whois service, especially our little UI, our thin UI front end, you'll get referrals at the HTTP level. And if you wanted to, you could actually embed them in the payloads that you return as well. So what that allows you to do, that allows you to link between your entities within your own system, and if you wanted to, link to entities in other people's systems. So, furthermore, HTTP has authentication, and authentication is the first piece of the puzzle if you want to do authorization. And what that means is you can, the community at large can then start thinking about authorization policies that don't start off with everyone gets the data. So, and finally, one of the other benefits of reusing all this infrastructure is you can get versioning. One of the problems with some of the protocols is we want to, you know, you've got a data schema based on the type of data or the type of data model that you had today. And then in 5 years, you need to add something or change something, or you want to upversion it or something like that. And what happens is you have to have a mechanism to version those schemas, to version the output of the data you're using. With HTTP, you get that with a simple accept header. It's built in right there. Again, as I said, to do this for the ICANN community, you can't just say go do RESTful Web Services. Someone has to actually create a standard or a specification. There's a couple of things you want to do. You want to define URL patterns. You want to define schemas of some type. I don't recommend XML schema if you're going down the XML route. You could also take the work that the IETF did with in the CRISP working group to create dereg. And then you have define your patterns. And boom, you're done. That's what it takes. And that's what we did, actually. So let me talk to you about Aaron's experience with a RESTful service here. I would actually not be truthful if I told you what we did when we came up with this RESTful web service was we went into the office one day and said, hey, you know what the world needs is a Whois RESTful web service. The world does need that. But that's not what our primary motivator was. What happened at Aaron, we were doing a lot of re-engineering. And a lot of it was around changing the data model in our registration database to better support DNSSEC and lame delegation checking. But what that meant was we had to rewrite just about everything in our system. And we're, in fact, still doing that. Everything, I think, but the billing system had to be redone. And we just did that, too, as well. So, but that meant we had to redo the legacy Whois system. And so when we took a step back and said, hey, we're going to redo this legacy Whois system, first off, let's go above and beyond what we already have, and let's do it better. We also wanted to be simple about it, too. So the approach we took was we had already come up with this thing called Aaron Online, which is basically people can log into a portal or I don't know what you want to call it, a self-service website for Aaron, and they can administer their data. We wanted to take that code and reuse it for the RESTful web service as well. And what I did was over a matter of, I think, a couple of months, it wasn't a long time. In my spare time when I wasn't attending meetings that Mark scheduled me into, I was actually hacking against this, trying to come up with a technology demonstrator. Didn't take me a whole lot of time to do it. But the original idea was we were going to have a RESTful web service that reused our core libraries to talk to our database. And then to continue port 43 service, we were going to write a port 43 proxy, which then just took Whois proxies, the current Whois proxies that we had, and made them RESTful calls. The level of effort on that, we didn't really break it out into protocol versus non-protocol. But once it was green-lighted, we didn't have a large team on there. We had a single senior engineer for a couple of months, I think only two. And then once he got going, we actually assigned a couple more engineers to it. And lo and behold, we had it. But like I said, we were also solving some non-protocol problems as well. We created a new replication technology specific to Aaron. We also, at this point, until we did our RESTful WHOIS service, we didn't actually support CIDR queries either. And that was one of the things we wanted to add in there. So we now support CIDR queries. So we had to come up with ways for searching, doing efficient CIDR searches. And one of the other things we did was we spent a non-trivial amount of time trying to make sure that when someone queries port 43 and we did these calls into the RESTful web service, that the data that got put back on port 43 looked like what they used to have on port 43. That was quite expensive. So adoption, so I said we announced this in 2009. I think also at the same time we put out a pilot service. If it wasn't at the same time, it was shortly thereafter. What we had immediately was we had a couple of people who wanted to reconcile. They were doing auditing of their own data. So they were auditing what data the data they had, you know, they had told us about their networks and their infrastructure versus what they had in their own database. And so they were actually using our programmatic interface that we put up as a demonstration. Immediately, we also had someone who wrote a Flash application. I never wanted to go prying around. You know, you're not really supposed to be investigating who's querying you like that. But we could tell it was a Flash application, and so someone before we even went production with this actually had a Flash app on the web for this thing. After we were released, our numbers are kind of hard to come by because things kind of went berserk. Our query rates skyrocketed, both on port 43 and port 80. We went from 600 queries a second to around 5,600 queries a second the day we did this. And we've kind of had some up and downs in the query patterns since then. Things have settled back down a little bit, but they're still higher than what they used to be. I believe back of the envelope, what I was just checking on today, actually, our RESTful queries are now 18 to 20% for 2011, 18 to 20% of our overall query rate. So we've got quite good adoption. One of the other things is based on immediate feedback from the website, the people coming over port 80 before we actually launched the service, our weblog statistics showed that it wasn't well used. Once we launched the service, we got feedback from people saying, "Hey, you know what? I like to use the port 80 stuff, but here's a way of making it better." And so we came up with this thing called PFT, which basically is a pseudo resource in RESTful terms to help people using browsers get our data better. And again, as I said, the demand for the WHOIS RESTful service nearly immediately after going production with this thing, we had several people approach us and say, "Hey, this is great. We can finally see our data in, you know, in a scriptable way in your registration database. Now what you need to do is you need to allow us to modify it via RESTful web service." And so we're actually on the eve of doing that. In fact, Mark and I got to fly back tonight because that's going out in a matter of days. So in conclusion, if you want to see our service, it's production, whois.aaron.net. We also have a technical mailing list for all things technical at Aaron called Aaron Tech Discuss at Aaron.net. You can send questions there, or you can send questions directly to me if you want to. And that's it. Questions?
Over here. And then on the left. And then on the right.
Hello. It's great to see that you're adapting to this great technology from the web, actually. And I was wondering that there are actually a few data that are expected from the WHOIS servers, like name and organization name, first name, last name, and others. And most of registries are also using custom data, you know, like the case for sunrise issues and other cases, but I was wondering if there's going to be, are you going to use, for example, name XML namespaces, and there would be a standard namespace for the common data, and registries can define their own namespace for additional data. And also, I want to know if there's going to be any also semantic web technologies are going to be used here too, or it's just XML and that's it.
So for starters, we have a specification. It's an Aaron specification. It is not a, I mean, it's not a standard, right? We haven't gone to a standards body with this. The way we did do it is we created RelaxNG schemas, which we publish for XML, and we defined a namespace for the core data sets that we have. We also put hooks, plenty of hooks, everywhere, every place we could in the XML to say you can put in XML elements from another namespace, and we don't care what it is. It'll validate. So later on, and we have done this. We actually had to come back just 2 months ago, I guess, when we did another version of our Who is RESTful service. We actually added in other elements for delegation queries, which we're about to introduce real soon now. So that's the first part. We also, because we're doing output, and I guess we could do this on our provisioning side, but I'm not really all hot about doing it there. But our RESTful Who Is service supports both XML and JSON and plain text and plain, I guess it's application HTML, straight HTML. Actually, it's XHTML. But so we will actually output in those four formats if we want to. And the JSON layer, which is probably the most interesting one, versus XML, is really just a translation library that we have. It's called Badgerfish. We didn't write it. But we found it, and we went, hey, this is kind of cool. And so all we had to do was create an XML version of what we wanted, and we automatically get the JSON version as well. For the plain text and the HTML, we had to write style sheets, and that's how we did that. So.
What I meant was that, for example, in semantic web, you can create classes, and you can actually talk about those data on the web, for example, in an additional repository, and you know.
I'm not following.
I'll take you.
If you can, we can take it offline. Gentleman on the right, thanks.
Despite I'm not in favor of putting everything on HTTP and creating an overlay net over the internet, I'm pretty impressed by this service here. And two remarks. First remark, please provide specifications to the XML so that we can validate the response automatically. First point. And second point, it's already missing on the ripe side. And the second point, provide a version identifier. So if you want to change this interface and you are aiming to automatic tools here, you can still run the old interface without changing it. That would be very fine. If we find this, we can refer this to this and saying, oh, we like to have the version 1.3 for all communication, and then if you have the other in production and we have changed our tools, use the other version. That would be fine if we can have coexistent versions, but we do not have on Who is service at the moment.
Thank you. I forgot one thing. The next time when you ask a question, please indicate your name and your affiliation. Thanks.
Lutz Donaka.
Yeah. So as far as Ripe NCC goes, they kind of did this at the same time we did, and there wasn't a whole lot of collaboration going on. I mean, they told us about it, and we told them we were doing this. And from the perspective of both organizations, it wasn't a, hey, let's try to standardize something. It was a, hey, let's try to see what we can do. The Ripe NCC and Aaron have somewhat differing data models, somewhat differing ways of provisioning the data. And so the original effort wasn't to try to come up with a standard. It was to try to see what each organization could do. If they don't provide a schema, I can suggest that to them next time I talk to someone from the RIPE NCC, I guess. We do. We actually have a zip file somewhere on this webpage. I don't want to go searching for it. But we actually took all our RelaxNG schemas and zipped them up, and they're publicly available. Oh, yeah, Mark's pointing it out. It's right here. So, but if you go to the whois.aaron.net, on the sidebar, there's a thing that says who is technical information or API documentation, and you'll get this webpage. And basically, it describes a FAQ, and then there's an actual specific, what I guess we call it, our API documentation on how to do this. It's in here somewhere. So that's what Aaron provides.
Thank you. Jim?
So I want to – this is Jim Galvin from Afilias. I want to make a comment and just to have you confirm it to make sure that I heard you correctly. I think that you actually – you did at one point mention that there are two things here that you have talked about and presented. So we call it RESTful Who Is, but you've actually provided two things, one which is a description of the service level, so which I think is what's all about building something on top of a RESTful framework, right? So there's some data that's back there, but you've got this layer on top, which is the service, which provides all the access to it and the mechanism for querying that data stream and stuff. And you did comment at one point that there's also a data model that you had defined. And in fact, I believe you were saying that what motivated this work in the first place was that you wanted to change your data model and all of your data. And you're nodding your head, so that's good, and I'll go on. So I think what's important here is just reminding ourselves from the Cartagena meeting, we had actually said before that there really, when we say who is, and every time we say who is, what's important here is there really are three things, at least, that we could be talking about. One is the service level component, one is the data level component, and then, of course, there's the protocol underneath. We need to be careful about those three things and recognize that we're talking about three different things and what they are. So, thank you.
Yeah, it might be RFC 3707. There's some RFC somewhere that actually does spell that out, and I can't remember which one it is, but yeah.
Dave?
So, Andy, I have a favor to ask of you. If you could, you're on a Mac, right? So if you could open up a terminal window and you could go through the following demonstration, just do a curl command on that same URL that you grabbed, or like, you know, on 192.168.0.0 to show the, you can show the XML output. So you probably
Let me
see
let me
that.
Do one better. Let me use XML lint.
That's even better, right?
If you use XML lint, which is a program which basically it's you know, if you're a C programmer used to lint, XML lint is kind of the same thing. It lets you know when all the bad stuff you've done. So I believe this is the one for Mark and
right.
Me.
That's,
And so there, that's all I did to get Mark's information.
Right.
And if I wanted to be, depending on how I wanted to, how perfect I wanted to get it or whatnot, I have written simple, very simple CSS style sheets, and there's another command line program called XSLT proc, which you can run. You can give it that same URL, run it through a style sheet, and it would just pull out his name and an address if I wanted to, or whatever I want. So,
you might. Yeah, the reason I asked to have this done was for those of you who are, you know, who are not technical and just trying to appreciate, you know, some of the subtleties. This is the raw data that someone who is trying to use automation or a program to analyze who is, for example, someone is looking for a potential a point of contact for a fish domain or the like, would be able to use this structure, which if it were standardized across all TLDs, would be, you know, a tremendous benefit to anyone who had to use who is in large volumes. So.
Thank you, Dave. Danny and then Jay.
So Andy, I got a couple of questions. First, you talked a little bit about this up front. There's three parts. I'll just list them all, and you can whatever. But anything unique with regards to IDN to where this positions us better? And I know you commented on that. Second one is from a standards or a publication perspective, what might need to be done to get this to a more wide audience or with the standard schema set, whatever that looks like at each level, each of those three levels Jim outlined. And then finally, what you think maybe challenges in particular if this were to be adapted for domain data, for example.
You identify your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought, Danny McPherson.
So I put in the presentation internationalization issues, which are actually encompasses more than IDN. IDN is actually a very particular type of internationalization issue. The Chris Working Group actually touched on IDNs. They had the thing called IDN variants, which came out of also reuse of something from the IDN Working Group as well. And basically, you could query against a variant in Iris. You could query against a domain name and get its variants, that type of thing. And I believe that was the support that was put in for in Iris. It's all XML in Iris. You could do the same thing here. Do the exact same thing here. I'm not an IDN expert, so I don't know all the intricacies of what you would need to support it. But that's what Iris does, and so you could easily replicate that here. As far as going to standards or specification or whatever, it depends on the standards body. I guess if we were talking about the IETF, we would have to go through the standard process of doing a BOF or whatever. And then getting the ISG to agree to a working group. A standard is really just what people read off of a piece of paper that when it gets down to it. But if we wanted a formal standards body to seal of approval, that's probably the way to go. And as far as challenges go, like I said, the implementation of the RESTful side, the actual web service, for us was fairly simple and straightforward. Our biggest challenge was trying to get port 43 to act right. We rewrote our port 43 daemons, and they're basically these big proxies that take a Whois query and turn around and ask for a RESTful query in response. And our biggest challenge was trying to get that information back to the users in the way they had seen it previously. And trying not to what we thought would be breaking Whois clients, that's one of the reasons why port 43 is such a hassle, is because you really don't know what you're breaking when you change port 43. There's no specification out there other than send line of text, carriage return, wait for the socket to close on you. And so we had no idea what the client behavior was. And we are still today discovering different things. One of the things we did, and this is actually intersects with IDNs, was during our analysis we realized in some certain Whois clients, when you put a dot in the query string for the Whois client, in some cases, for some reason, it interprets that as an IDN. I don't know why. I don't know why space dot space is an IDN, but it is. To some Whois clients. Turns out that dot was actually one of our flags for signaling, I think, names. I want to query a name record. I want to query the name of a record for our query formats. And so that was quite. So what it did was it meant that some people couldn't actually query our Whois records properly. So we actually had to come up with another flag to work around that. So that was an IDN issue. One issue we kind of came to grips with just recently was some Whois clients, when they query Aaron for AS records, they query us differently than what they query Ripe and APNIC for. And the clients don't tell you they're doing this, they just do this. And so we had some unexpected results of people with different Whois clients doing the same query but getting different results back, and no one could figure it out until we actually went and did some snooping and went, oh, wait a minute, the actual Whois client is changing the query out from underneath people, and that's because the client writer had a misconception of the way Whois records were, or AS records were formulated within the Aaron system. So.
Thank you. Jay?
Thanks. Jay Daly from .nz. Two things. First of all, I'm right in thinking that the only bit of the technology that you've presented here that can't be replicated in Whois is the use of standard web-based tools such as caches, security analyzers, statistics gatherers, and web libraries. But everything else in terms of specifying a syntax for queries, specifying syntax for responses, and on the other side of things there, can all be replicated through Whois if we chose to do that.
I would say you're wrong. Security can't be done. I don't know how you're going to do unless you want to create another port for SSL over Whois or something like that. If you wanted to try to put whatever hooks in for things that are equivalent to a username and password, that would be kind of that challenge response would kind of be difficult over Whois. The other thing is that if you wanted UTF-8 or UTF-16 over Whois, you have no idea which clients you're breaking. The IETF actually went and discussed this, that very issue, before, and they determined that you could not actually say that a Whois client or Whois server can return UTF-8 safely.
Okay, that's one of the. Sorry, yeah. So that's well, two things. Okay, on the security side, I think it's possible, but through things like client certificates, which aren't necessarily practical. That's a very different reason. And on the UTF-8, that's possible, again, through a standardized flag, but again, it's not necessarily practical to do that. It's a different matter. But the second question, then, was, would you say that there is a trade-off here in terms of the ease of use with the complexity for a developer now? For a developer to create something that talks to Whois on port 43... is trivial in that sense. To open the port, send the string, get the response back, that's it. With web protocols, that's more complex, and it's also more complex for the implementer of the server to do that as well. They can use a toolkit to do it, but say they want to add something like token bucket algorithms for flow control, that's going to be much more complex than to do with a web-based interface.
No, I would also disagree on that, too.
Okay.
Speaking of someone who just recently went through writing a port 43 daemon, we had to basically, I forget the name of the package we ended up having to use, but we had to do a lot of special tricks with non-blocking I.O. in order to get it to perform right. For the web side, port 80 side, we used Apache. So there was no implementation from the daemon level that we had to do for the RESTful web service at all, period. We basically took our core library that talks to our database, put a RESTful engine on top of it, and boom, we were done. It was a matter of weeks for me to do that as a side project. The actual port 43 stuff was a lot longer and more involved. And you do have to be, if you're going to be someone who writes TCP daemons that take load, you have to know what you're doing. As far as a client writer goes, it really does depend on who the programmer is. There are some people who are programmers who have no idea what a socket is, a TCP socket is. I've run into them. They're not stupid. They've just never done it before. However, they know what a URL is. They know that in certain environments they can just say, here's a URL, I hand it to this thing, I get back data. And it's that simple. Whereas with a TCP client, you have to know, okay, well, if I'm gonna open the socket, I have to know how to read off the data, and for Whois, I especially have to know not to close the socket prematurely. So
thank you. Dave? Another question. Go ahead.
Lutz again. I love this presentation here, this output. It shows how common misunderstanding is created. Because you can read the output doesn't mean that you understand it. In this, especially XML is completely easy to misunderstand by saying there's a field called street address, so everything there must be an address of a street. It's not true. You need a semantics, you need a syntax definition here, you need a schema. Without this output is completely useless. So please always provide syntax, semantics, provide API documentation, and then and very, very good documentation here, and then say we can use it. Otherwise, we run in the same problem as we have in the SUSE now. People look at the output, say, oh, I understand it, use some regular expressions and say I have a program, a client. Doesn't work with XML.
Thank you.
Yeah, first off, I know plenty of programmers who've used regular expressions against XML and HTML over the years. That's a very cheap way of parsing it if you want to do that. It's not what I normally do, but I know plenty of people have done that. In our documentation, which I've got up here, let me try to increase the font. Basically, we talk about our data model, the different types of things. Now, I don't know how many people are familiar with the RIR space. It is a somewhat different data model than what you would have in domain names. We have things like autonomous system numbers, which, you know, if you're a domain registry or registrar, you've never heard of before. Some of the information is the same. We have orgs and contacts like you guys would. With DNSSEC, we have records for supporting DNS. RR sets and DNSSEC and so forth. But we talk about our different data models in here. We talk about the command line clients you could use, basically the how to specify different data formats, and somewhere in here is our zip file, which contains our schema and so forth. So we actually do provide documentation on how to talk to our service. Is it complete? I don't know. I'm sure that if this was to go to a standards body, you would have people who are actually professional writers or professional standards specification writers coming behind us and saying, okay, well, you did a good job here, but you could really beef this section up. And I'm sure that's true of even our documentation. So,
thank you. Any additional questions?
I just wanted to respond to Jay's analysis of the difference between WHOIS and RWS, and I think one of the things you can say one of two things if you go back to Andy's analysis of the control plane and data relationships. If you look at the original nickname protocol, the control plane was literally non-existent. There's only two criteria. You send a message and you end it with a carriage return and line feed. It doesn't even say that you have to send ASCII 7. It simply says the carriage return and line feed is ASCII 7. Well, that's as slim a control plane as you could possibly imagine. Right? So as a protocol architect, one could say I could construct any signaling protocol for the control plane over that channel, you know, so long as that channel continues to have the properties that the message is terminated with a carriage return and line feed. In fact, that's exactly what's happened in a non-standard fashion in WHOIS among all number of permutations and combinations of clients and servers. And so if you want to go and get kanji back from .jp, you can query on a command line with WHOIS, and you specify like a minus H. But if you'd use a minus H at a dozen other WHOIS servers, you will not get back kanji. And so one of the problems that I think we do have to recognize is we have a legacy issue in trying to take WHOIS. There's no version. There's no standard error codes. There's free form and per server data framing in the message response. And so when Steve Sheng and I looked at a lot of these issues, when we were first asked to look at the service requirements and catalog them for the GNSO, one of the things that we did try to identify were all the things that were non-standard and freeform that might be better served if we had a schema, if we had some standard semantics and syntax. And so that was one of the things that led us to really take a better and closer look at RWS.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Sorry, just one more thing. Dave, isn't that really the point, though, that the standard schema, standard semantics, and others are the things that we really should be talking about, and that comes first, and then after comes the technology by which we used to represent it?
And I guess my response to you is that we've done that. and it has been on presented to the GNSO almost almost a year ago, and I'm certainly happy to continue, and we're gonna transition from what we're doing now and look at some of the high level of that document. But it is a substantive work that was produced by staff at the request of the GNSO some time ago. So maybe we're all at a different point in time in terms of looking at that list of requirements and whittling down or expanding according to what the perceived need is.
Yeah. Well, of course, I'm not from the GNSO, from the CCNSO, that is not involved in that process at all. And as are some colleagues here as well. So I think that's it's interesting, but I don't think it legitimizes a decision that those are the set of new features that we should be putting, we should be looking at. I think there still needs to be a wider discussion.
Well, let's understand that what we have is a list of features, not a requirement set. Okay. So, and I think that the choice in the document that used the word requirement is one of those pitfalls that you can spend an awful lot of time in the snakes and weeds in an ICANN community. But when we were putting those together, it was a list of things that were desirable, not necessarily for everyone, but that someone at some point in time in the chronology of who is discussions said was desirable. Yeah.
Okay.
Dave, I think this document, I've been looking through it since Steve sent it out to the list and the pointer, and it's actually a really great document. There's a lot of good information in it. But I think you touched on the fact that it's not really, it's called a requirements document, but there's still, I guess, some room for interpretation on some elements. Some things in it are kind of recommendations almost versus hardcore requirements. And there's almost in the way it reads right now, there's a bit of a prioritization implied in, which element comes first, what's discussed, a natural prioritization in the document itself, but I don't know if that's an agreed-upon prioritization, because obviously there's a lot of work in this document, and you wouldn't do it necessarily all at once. I don't know that it would even make sense necessarily to do it all at once. What happened with the GNSO with this? I'm not really familiar with whether or not there was a mandate set by the GNSO to go ahead and produce work against this document and actually move ahead and, orientate some type of workforce towards it or working group towards it.
Hi, I'm Liz Gaster from the ICANN policy staff. The council hasn't talked about that paper yet, and it was written in July of 2010. We've been trying to get it back on the agenda because they've been so overloaded, and actually Steve and I just briefed them again on it earlier today at the open meeting. So what we're going to discuss in tomorrow's after meeting is how we're going to discuss that further. The council needs to talk about it. I think one thing is I'd be kind of interested in what you all think the council should do with it. And one possibility is to do nothing and itself, and to let you all work on it for a bit. The community, meaning the broader technical discussion, community. And I'm just throwing this out because, first of all, they're swamped with policy work. And because, I'm not sure I see this as a policy, as the next immediate next steps, as policy next steps. I see them as something much more exploratory and, you all know better than I, but a different kind of conversation. So in a sense, what I want to make sure is that that report doesn't just languish with no one reading it and no one deriving any value from it, since the council asked for it and we did it. But my own reaction is to think, it might be of more use to many of you than it would be for the council right now.
Sorry, I forgot to announce my name on the last time I spoke. I'm Michael Young, and I'm with Tiny Planet. I used to be with Aphilias. Some of you might know me better from those credentials. My thought, Liz, to your question, is that I almost want to take a bit of a clue from the IRT stuff. And I think if we're going to get work done on this, there has to be some type of real focused momentum. And I'd like to see if we can get someone in the GNSO to put forward a resolution or propose a resolution, and I'd be happy to draft one and put it through the council to see if we can get someone to put it on the table for a working group. Yeah. For a working group that would be having a very focused time period to go through this document and actually determine true, full agreed-upon requirements out of it so we get some work going on it. And I would say, you know, like a 60 and 90-day period, like put a real – I mean, the material is all here. It's just a matter of getting consensus and decisions made. And obviously you'd want some representation from interested stakeholders in that working group.
Could you just elaborate for me the consensus and decisions that you think could get teased out in that 60 to 90 days? Like, what's your image of what that is for the council to say that these are the right requirements or the wrong requirements or, you know, modify the requirements in some way? Is that what you're
– There's some fuzziness in these requirements. You know, we could do it this way, we could do it that way. So those kind of questions need to be clarified in it. There's some suggested requirements that I don't know really need to be done right now. Maybe they do. I mean, it's a nice idea. The who was is an example that comes to mind. And I think that's kind of I like it personally. But on the other hand, when I'm sitting there thinking about work we need to get done right now, I'm not sure whether or not that's something that needs to be focused on in the short term or whether that's really kind of another service altogether.
I was just going to talk about that list of the requirements, the GNSO.
You know, I guess I just really, this is a very candid personal opinion, but I don't think the GNSO is ready for this. I don't think they understand in detail those requirements. It's overall, and I don't want to speak about them in a monolithic way. So I hope, you know, everyone takes this with the respect that I mean. They're swamped with other issues. These are very technical elements. I don't think they really understand or have read the report or even appreciate that list, that compilation list fully that Steve put up. Some may really in a very deep way, but overall I think there's kind of an education necessary. And, you know, they asked for the report in May of 2009. We wrote it in July of 2010. They haven't looked at it since. I don't think they know what to do with it. And my own sense is if it would be at all possible, is for you all to help them. Take a look at it yourselves. Say, if you were them, what would you change or clarify or make less fuzzy? And kind of present that.
Okay, I just want to make one important point. As Jay pointed out earlier, and I think it should not be underplayed. He is not. He is from a CCTLD, and there are other, there are at least five other CCTLD participants that I can count. And I don't know you all, and it seems to me that one of the values of having this committee or this group of people work together is that who is implemented by, the GTLDs in a or a successor directory service that's implemented by the GTLDs in a dramatically different fashion than the way that the CCTLDs would implement it is not a very desirable outcome. And so it seems that it would be much better if what we have is technical people who want to get together from both the CCTLD and GTLD community to try to work together and come up with some my best scenario would be some thoughts for how to do some experimentation. I'm not even looking down the road for policy yet. But, one of the things that we've talked about, we meaning, some of the folks who are experimenting at ARIN, some of the folks who are experimenting as ICANN technical staff who are protocol engineers, is, does this work? How does it work? What would we need to do if we threw together a prototype and we actually prove that we can do it? What can we learn from it? And I come from the IETF side of this world where we put together rough code and then we sought consensus. And so we tried to understand what it was we were going to throw over the wall as engineers to policy before we asked exactly what are the requirements. And so I think that where we are at this point is we've got a very, very large pile of possible requirements. And we've got this Canada protocol that from 50,000 feet looks like it might be able to solve a significant amount of the problem, because we've seen those problems solved in the HTTP world for a number of similar or like problems. So, one of the things that that raises my enthusiasm about getting you all together is, let's see if we can just agree. Maybe the right thing to do is to play with this protocol for a while. See which of the grab some of the requirements, a nice subset, and say, if we had to identify even like five of the requirements that are backbreakers like now, like internationalized registration data, choose three or four of your own, and then a standard schema, standard error reporting. Those are the ones that seem to be really important to me. If we were to prove that it works for those, and we were to experiment with it, would that be a useful way forward to say, look, we've made some progress, we've headed down this path, and so far we've got some success.
Jay, go ahead.
Yes, I think it is very useful, but I think that we can actually try to narrow this problem slightly even further. To me, there are, of all the requirements that we've seen people discussing and documenting, they come into two categories. Those that can possibly be implemented in the current WHOIS without breaking it very much, if at all, okay, and can solve some urgent problems, by which specifically I mean things like UTF-8 and other things there. Okay, then there are the other ones that we all know simply cannot be done in WHOIS and which need to be done in a separate directory service. And those, to me, are two very different streams. And what I'm worried about is seeing the urgency of issues with the former, with the WHOIS things, trying to drive the establishment of the latter. And that's what I don't want. That's why I want the little bits of the WHOIS that we can do, that we can fix, that we can sort out, we do. We leave that to one side, and we then give ourselves time correctly to do the new directory service with all of those feature sets in it if necessary.
What do people... Jim, you want to say something?
So I heard Liz suggesting that this group should form an opinion and offer some comments back to the GNSO. But I'm going to ask a question that I asked, in Cartagena, and I think it still applies here, too. I mean, from where does this group derive any accountability to do anything? I mean, it's just a workshop. We've been putting stuff in front of a group of people, but to what end? And you also comment about with all due respect, educating GNSO council members, and I mean that quite sincerely. But if we're going to do that, why aren't they here just sort of taking all this in while like we are too? I mean, it seems to me if that's the process we're going to go down, we should be in their meeting. I mean,
Go ahead, Mike.
First of all, Dave, jumping back, I think ideally, and I'm not exactly sure how these things would work across different supporting organizations, but that would be ideal, right, to make sure that any stakeholder supporting organizations are in agreement or in consensus or in support of an effort around this. So, I didn't mean to focus on just the GNSO, but, what I heard Liz saying, and maybe I misunderstood Liz, is that the work that was done to date was kind of driven through the GNSO, so I was thinking full circle back to them. But it's not just exclusive. The interests are not exclusive to the GNSO at all, right? In fact, the CCs probably have a more immediate concern or need with IDN registries going up, IDN.IDN registries, in the CCs. So, and I think Jay's point in trying to separate out both like the short-term stuff that needs to be addressed and then maybe working a longer project, Dave, which is kind of where I would see doing prototyping and proof of concept and so forth would be important. Because I see value in what you said, Dave, but I'm concerned that we have a clock issue here. Right, and if we don't get something addressed, you're going to end up with a bastardization of different technologies again, because people need to just get the job done.
Well, that's what we already have. We're there, whether people want to admit it or not.
I want to respond to Jim, though, if I can.
Well, I wanted to respond to Jay, so that trumps.
Give the gentleman at the end near Andy a chance first.
I think one comment is necessary with respect to the question, why aren't these people showing up?
I think they just simply don't care. That what they say, give us a spec, we'll do it. You know, somebody please give us one. But they're really so tired of going from one meeting to another and talking about where things should be done. Ideally, for most of us, you know, it would be handled like when the escrow specification was developed by someone. You know, you could say, who cares what kind of escrow we do? We just, you know, we send it down there. And, of course, what worries me is we say we make it a long process of defining things the right way. Most of the stuff that we've done haven't been defined the right way. They just kind of, somebody proposed them, and they were done. And if we define the right way, we take too long, then it's not going to go anywhere. So about addressing this existing WHOIS protocol, that's nice. I mean, if we'd done that 10 years ago, it would have been okay. But right now, if we say, we want just to have a good pretext to say, we just sent down on port 43 the domain name and say, that's it, it exists, and nothing else. And if you want to have anything further, go to a decent protocol to pick it up. That's the thing that we would like to be able to in the context of GTLD registries and registrars who also run WHOIS services.
I'm going to trump you because Jay spoke first, so
yes,
trying
please.
To reestablish sync here. I actually like the idea of trying to try and identify the things that we, at least you speculate, we could do with WHOIS today, because we're probably going to have an interesting discussion about that. And I have no issue with doing that in parallel with looking at, you know, a successor, because I think that's what we tried to do with IPv6, and, you know, and what we ended up doing, you know, if, for those of you who know, is that we ended up, you know, trying to retrofit and put everything into IPv4, you know, that we could, that looked like it was going to be in IPv6, and one of the consequences was that we stalled on IPv6 for nearly 15 years. So I would consider that an undesirable outcome, but I would accept it because I'll be 70 at that point. I wouldn't care. Right. So yeah. With that little caveat, it sounds to me like there is the possibility of a couple of different ways to approach this in a very techie way. And back in the day in the IETF, we used to do these things and have skunkworks projects or experimental projects, and then we do some bake-offs. Okay, you know, we think we can do this in WHOIS. Let's see if we can go prove we can do it in WHOIS. In the meantime, we also have the same challenge of doing it in some other protocol. And seeing what the complexities are. We used to sit down technically and intellectually go, this is how much time it took, this is the amount of code it was, we shared the code, and one of the desirable outcomes of those is usually that there were implementations that could be reference implementations or open source implementations that might be made publicly available for anyone to use, which means that, you know, there might be some reasonable good quality and inexpensive or free code available for everyone to build on. And that's, you know, it's usually, I know that lots of people don't like, you know, very, very closed gene pools, but in these particular cases, that's also a very, you know, useful way to build things. Monocultures aren't always bad. So.
Before you respond to me, this is Jim Galvin. Let me respond to Dave and to Jay here then. So it's okay if you don't get to my question. I'm not, you know, I, yeah. You know, in this issue of experimenting, so you're talking about experimenting at one particular level, which is at the service level, right? I mean, at least that's what it sounds like. Because to me, the foundation on which all of this is built is the data model, okay? And I would assert that we have no agreement in ICANN as to exactly what is registration data and what that data model is. And you know, I mean, the obvious distinction to put out there is that the rules are different for registries than they are from registrars, if you look at the WHOIS requirements. I mean, the differences aren't necessarily big, but there are differences. So if you're going to experiment, you're adding another variable into the experimentation. Maybe that's okay from the point of view of an experiment, but I think it's important to call that out. I mean, there's that base is missing.
Kathy?
I'm Kathy Kleiman. Sorry to be late to the meeting, and I'm going to issue a big disclaimer, which I hate doing, that I'm doing this in my personal capacity, not as director of policy for PIR, and not as vice chair of the WHOIS review team. We've got a big problem here. The GNSO doesn't know what it wants, and I'm a veteran of the Who Is Wars of the last 8 years. We should have done this 10 years ago, but the GNSO couldn't figure out, and the DNSO before that couldn't figure out what they wanted in terms of requirements. And that's really hard, because as a former programmer, how can you create a system when the community can't give you the requirements? This is a big problem. I wouldn't put it on a fast track into the GNSO. You're still, you know, after 8 years, if we can't resolve it, we're not going to suddenly resolve it if there's a quick deadline. One of the things the Who Is Review Team is trying to do is pull out and try to figure out why we've been stuck on the issue of the data and the control and the directory service controls for so many years. The CCTLDs may be the answer, Jay. There's certainly one of the things that the GNSO will be looking at, that the Who Is Review Team is looking at, is do the CCTLDs provide some kind of model, some kind of array of best practices, some kind of array of variations of what's been done, looking at the different problems. So I think that may be an interesting way to go, is working through with CCTLDs, CCNSO, other models outside of the GTLDs. To move forward on technically with new options.
Can I jump in now? I think actually Kathy is a great, saying much of how I was feeling in wanting to respond to both Jim and to Michael. You could tell I was very hesitant about the GNSO, primarily because the GNSO is a policy development making body, and I just don't think this is ready for that yet. I think many of us want to put our discussion groups into homes. You know, they just, it's the ICANN way. You know, you have, it's an SSEC thing, or it's a GNSO thing, or it's a CCNSO thing, or it's an ALAC thing. And lately, we're getting really big on these cross community working groups. And that's another way to handle something like this, is to do it in a cross community working group. The thing that's making me very uncomfortable about formalizing any kind of group within the ICANN auspices is because so many of you have told us that it's not ready for policy development, so what's ICANN's role? Or that it's a standards development issue, and so why is ICANN assuming a role in standards development? I'm very sensitive to those concerns. I think what we are trying to do is share information we have about the limitations and some of these alternative technologies. And thank you so much for coming today and sharing your experience, because we want to facilitate progress. But we're also very respectful of the fact that ICANN does have a limited role, a limited scope, and that the SOs are policy development institutions. Do we think the SOs, that this is ready for the SOs to work on? So there are different constructs for how we could continue a dialogue. You know, the one I kind of started with was just, let's set up a wiki, let's, you know, set up this discussion group, let ICANN provide you with you know, the forum, the facilitators, the note takers, and the expertise that Dave and Steve and Francisco bring, and you help us figure out where everyone should go. If people are still thinking that there needs to be some auspices under which this occurs within ICANN, just the discussion, then I think it's also possible to come up, you talked about a resolution, it's also possible to come up with a model where a cross-community working group could be established, you know, with requests for technical contributors, and, you know, with a lot of warnings that we're not going in the policy direction, and that the purpose is to funnel the information that you develop into the process you think it belongs, like the IETF or wherever you think it belongs. But, you know, I'm just conscious that that raises concerns that, you know, that we have to answer, Steve and Dave and I, about what ICANN is doing in this bailiwick.
So I'd like to make the observation that there are people here from ALAC, from SAC, from the GNSO, from the CCNSO. It's already a cross-constituency, cross-SOAC initiative. And from you know, the fact that I didn't see a lot of people glazing over through Andy's presentation, it seems to me that a fair number of the people that are in the room, especially the ones that have remained, have enough technical inertia to want to continue to dialogue. And so, at the risk of overstepping my role, perhaps what we could do is try to formulate a request to the board and say we would like, in the same way that ESSAC made a request to the board in SAC 37 to form something on that some group of SOAC experts who would look at internationalized registration data to sort of frame out what it is that we'd like to look at. And I think that Jay's pointed out at least a couple of things we could mention. You know, what are the things that we need to identify, you know, that could possibly be solved in the current WHOIS environment? What things do we acknowledge are not going to be solved by the current WHOIS protocol and service environment? And is there an indication from some people here, should we experiment with some protocols in conjunction with the IETF? So I think that those are the three formulations I would put forward as possible elements to this request to the board.
Data model.
And data model, yes.
Okay, if I just add... thank you, Steve. We need to be careful about this view that there is... that people aren't ready for this. I agree that, you know, for some of the things we're talking about, people aren't ready for it. But for things like solving UTF-8 or in order to help internationalisation within WHOIS, either we do that very quickly or we say we can't do that very quickly. I don't think that can hang around, that one. And there are a couple of them that need to be done relatively quickly like that. You know, I think they're solvable, but that's very separate from the other one. Standardisation of the data model, adding on new features, that potentially is a very long discussion. I agree with you, Dave, it needs to start in parallel, but we mustn't let the potential scope of that one put us off the urgent bits that sit there at the front.
Michael?
So I think we're all aligned in what we'd like to do, Dave. I mean, we've had conversations about these sort of things before, and I personally would love to see a new WHOIS server out there and a protocol that makes sense to everybody. I guess the question is, again, we were just going around circles, maybe how to get it done. And it's an interesting, I guess when you're talking about getting multiple supporting organizations involved, you know, it makes sense to have it be a board level directive because, you know, what else? That's the next layer over multiple supporting organizations. But I worry about it. Yeah, I worry that. Sorry, go ahead, Liz.
I was just going to say it's not necessary, though. I mean, there's no reason why, a sponsoring organization that feels that this is a priority, whether it be the GNSO, the ESSAC, the ALAC, you know, all of your supporting organizations, pick one, start there,
yeah.
Draft a charter. You know, we could help you with the drafting of the charter and then just, you know, circulate it.
Yeah.
It can be done. You know, I was trying to – I think there probably needs to be some caveat in that language about what ICANN's role in this is just to, you know, the inevitable questions about it. But that can be done in that route, and if that makes people feel more comfortable, you know, we're happy to support it. It's the kind of input we want in
yeah.
terms of what the next step should be. It's
so I – you know, the point I was going to wrap around to, whatever mechanism – that gets applied to make this happen, and you know, I'm happy to try and help in any way I can in that regard. But I do worry that, you know, when I've worked in companies in the past, sometimes we push up ideas or concepts from the technology groups, and those business people that think they're supposed to be putting the requirements together have failed to do so, or failed to move, or failed to understand what the technology can do for them or can't do for them. And, you know, there's frankly been a little bit of railroading from the technology groups, and we just get the job done. And the term that always gets bounced around at that point is a lot of anger and accusations like you've made a technocratic decision. That's the term I've heard many times in my life that really, really gets my goat. I do worry that we need a strategy around the GNSO in particular, because I've seen them get their back up over things that they feel might be railroading. And maybe that's just socializing, talking with the counselors, making sure that the work moves forward in a non-threatening way. But in so much as it's difficult to get them all to agree to a mandate of work, maybe if a different supporting organization is officially the sponsor, you also don't want the GNSO to be perceived that they feel threatened and they need to stop it somehow. because really, you know, their perspective on the contracted party's house in there in particular is going to be this impacts their business model. This costs them money to deal with. So.
I'm going to, well, I'm sharing it, so I'm going to share it. So America Koenigs is indicating that there are still some seats left if people want to go and see President Clinton. I would like to thank everyone because this was, I think, you know, a really, really worthwhile expansion. No comments. Shh, wait.
I do, because I've made some annoying questions and asked difficult things, and I just want to take a step back and offer that I thank Liz and Dave for your comments and your answers, and I appreciate them, and I actually do like this forum. Yeah. I think the fact that we're having a dialogue is a very good thing,
so
I want you to know that I'm supportive, and I just wanted that on the record.
Okay, it's on the record, but just let me get this out. I will take as a responsibility to capture what I believe were the points that Jay made and that we think we are in agreement with, to see if what we can do is then, you know, on the Tech Who Is list, formulate the kind of environment and way forward that it sounds like we came up with, you know, we came up with this afternoon. So I'll put it on the tech list. If you're not on the list, it's tech-whois@icann.org. Is that right?
If you're not on the list but wish to enroll, just talk to me. I'll just add you right now.
Because it is open, we are transparent, we are a legend.
And we need volunteers.